There's something quite fascinating about photo albums, especially family photo albums. When I was growing up, what I loved to do was slip into my dad's office where the photo albums were, and I would slide them out, and I would start to look at the pictures of when I was a little child or when I was a little bit older, or pictures of my parents. And it was amazing because the paper, there's something about looking at pictures in paper and not on a screen. You get to see people as they really are. The paper feels older. The people look funnier. The clothes look terrible. The hairstyles are bad. And you just wonder, how did anybody ever think that this was a good plan to wear polyester suits in the middle of August? Well, when we see our lives on those in those photo albums with the context of space and time, everything suddenly looks different, doesn't it? It looks quite amazing to see our lives through the window of the story of our family. Did I really wear those funny sweaters? Did I really have hair at one point? Did I look like that? And suddenly, as we look at these things, we're amazed, we're shocked, we're surprised at how we were a particular people in a particular place and a particular time. And so these photos of parents, of ancestors, of great-grandparents, we never met, and we've never realized how our life flashes before us, how everything is so different. Now, when it comes to the Bible, I think there's a sense in which we look at it like a smattering of stories and of a bunch of dislocated stories that have no joint together. We think of them as, one scholar has called it stringing pearls on a string, as though there's no rhyme or reason to it, as though they don't fit together. But we can get the idea that all the things in the Bible are intended for us, that God's plan for us is that, well, there's leaven, and we need to remove leaven from our homes, so what's the leaven I must remove from my home? And why can't I touch a pig skin? And I need to follow David's example and slay the giant in my life. And I need to get out of the boat, and I need to follow Jesus. And suddenly the story of the Bible, we've turned it into something that's, well, totally different than anything that it actually is. Because like a photo album, we've made it into all about us, where every story is about us, where every example is about us. But that's not really the thing that matters when we look at the picture. The picture of the Bible, you see, has many, many minor characters from the beginning to the end. And as we look at that plot line and as we examine it, they're all the supporting cast. And it would be crazy to think for just one moment that in that supporting cast, that we should think that the minor character is the most important person who ever stepped on the stage. That the person who really matters, who really is important, is the person who just blipped on the scene and fell off the scene. But that's often how we treat the story of our lives. We place ourselves in God's story of redemption as though God cares about every player in the skit, which he does, but we act as though the minor character, you or me, is actually the major character. And so we wonder then, what's the Bible about? What's the point of the Bible? If the Bible is not all about you and me, what's it about? Well, I think from this passage here, where Jesus meets these disciples on the road to Emmaus, it begins to unpack some questions for us to think through. Is the Bible all about you, or is the Bible all about Jesus? Now, when I was growing up, I went to Sunday school, and there were wonderful people who taught me the Bible. But what they did was that they taught me the Bible in such a way that I could become a better person. There was an acronym that I grew up, and it was B-I-B-L-E, Basic Instructions Before Leaving Earth, B-I-B-L-E. And this profound acronym was to shape your thinking as to how you should come and expect that every time you open the Bible, God was going to speak to you and change you because there were some instructions for you to follow. Well, the saying is cute and it's helpful, but in reality, as we look at this acronym, what we discover is that it's not true. what I learned about in Sunday school was that the Bible was primarily about me. It was primarily about how I should behave, how I should live, how I could please God. But as I started studying the Bible, and as I came across other schools of thought on the Bible, I found something that was extremely freeing. I actually found that the Bible wasn't about me. Rather, it was about Jesus. And an amazing thing happened. And if it wasn't about my performance and my abilities, but about Jesus' performance and Jesus' abilities, then if I trusted him, if I believed him, then suddenly the pressure was off of me. I didn't feel this great weight. I didn't feel this demand. I didn't have this expectation that it was all about me. Rather, all of a sudden, what I discovered was that the Bible was all about him. And in seeing that the Bible was all about Jesus, I could discover something incredibly freeing. Because if Jesus is the true and better one who appears in the Bible story, then all along the way, we discover that Jesus is the true and better Adam. That though he was tested in the garden, a much tougher garden than the original Adam, than what he had ever faced, his obedience was perfect to the Father and was imputed to us. Jesus is the true, and he is the better Abel, whose blood was spilt, and it was spilt not for his guilt and for our guilt, but for our acquittal. Jesus is the true and better Abraham, who answered the call of God, who was told to leave a place that he was familiar and comfortable with, and was sent to a place where he would know the void, not knowing where he would go. Jesus is the true and better Isaac, who was the one and only son who was offered up on the mountain by his father and was nearly sacrificed for us all. And God said, "Hang on, Abraham, now I know that I truly know that you love me more than this, your one and only son." And so in the cross of Jesus, we see that God, the Father, sends his one and only son, his true son, and he shows us that he truly loves us. Jesus is the true and better Jacob, who wrestled and faced the blow of justice so that we would not take the wounds of justice, but receive the discipline of grace. Jesus is the true and better Joseph, who's at the right hand of the king and forgives those who betray him and who sell him into slavery, and yet uses his power to free them. Jesus is the true and better Moses, who stands in the gap, mediating a covenant between God and humanity. Jesus is the true and better Job, who is the true innocent sufferer, who intercedes for his friends when they don't know how to act any better. Jesus is the true and better David, whose victory becomes his people's victory by not even picking up a stone. And they do not accomplish it themselves, but find that their victory is accomplished for them. Jesus is the true and better Esther, who didn't just lose an earthly palace and who said, "I'll give up. If I perish, I perish." But the one who said, "I'll give up a heavenly palace of all of the comforts of heaven." And who said, "Not if I perish, but when I perish, I will perish and show that I truly love them." And Jesus is the true and better Jonah, who was cast out into the storm so that we can be brought in so where we are safe. He's the true Passover lamb. He's the true temple. He's the true prophet. He's the true king. He's the true priest. He's the true sacrifice. So guess what? The Bible isn't about you. And that's an incredibly freeing thing, because suddenly when Jesus says that all of these things are concerning him, from Moses and the law and the prophets, all of these things concern him, it suddenly takes the pressure off. It suddenly means that we don't have to feel this enormous weight and burden as though we have to perform somehow. And so when we see that the Bible is not all about us, it's not about the treadmill that we have to run, we can feel the love of God, that all that is required of us has been done for us. It's been given to us. And so we can live and love freely. So, if the Bible's not all about you, but it's all about Jesus, if it's not all about you becoming a better person, then is it about your performance or is it about his performance? So when I read all of the stories of the Bible, I thought it was about how I was to be good, I was to behave, how I was to be a better person. And since the Bible was basic instructions before leaving Earth, I had to figure out how I better act. Otherwise, I'd be in serious trouble. But the problem is that when I looked at the Bible story and as I saw the people that I was to emulate, well, they weren't the best examples. Cain kills his brother out of vengeance. Noah is a drunkard who exposes himself naked to his daughters. Jacob betrays his brother in a moment of weakness so that there's a pot of stew that he can eat. Moses has a fierce temper and he strikes the rock instead of speaking to it. David, he kills a man after sleeping with his wife and getting her pregnant and then discovers, well, I better do something to cover my tracks. Paul is a missionary who kills thousands before he comes to Christ. Peter is a loudmouth fisherman who pulls out his sword and doesn't have very good aim and accidentally cuts off an ear instead of cutting off a head. Like, really? These are the examples I'm to follow? This is not that great of a story. And if I'm really honest, if it's about my performance, if it's about me following examples who are really extraordinary, I'm in a lot of trouble. Because these examples are terrible. They're bad. They're horrible. They're sleeping with daughters. They're perverting justice. They're causing all sorts of chaos. But there is a better story in the Bible. And it's not about heroes or examples to follow or to avoid. And so, at the beginning of the Bible account, when the man and woman fall into sin, God comes and he says, I'll give you a deliverer. I'll give you a rescuer. The seed of the woman will crush the seed of the serpent. He will come, he will bruise his heel, but he will crush his head. And the story of the Bible then becomes about this one who is going to come and redeem us, rescue us, deliver us. And so there is someone who would come from Abraham, not by works, but by promise, to show that the impossible can be accomplished by God. Jacob tells us that God will not forget his promise when the woman of his dreams turns out to be the woman she isn't. Joseph tells us that though evil may happen to us, that God can turn all things into good. Moses reminds us that when we want fame or fortune, when we want to cut off these people who are so difficult, God's plan is better than all those other things, and he will bring us out of the house of bondage into the land of freedom. Joshua reminds us that though there are giants in the land, God will overcome all of them, not by might nor by power, but by his spirit. And David himself, threatened by the giant, he slays the giant by cutting off its head. And in cutting off its head, he gives the mortal wound to the head of the serpent so that the seed of the one might come forth. When we know that the Bible is the story of how God protects his seed so that he might bring about a rescuer, when there are images stamped throughout the Bible that are telling us of something better, something greater, well then, the Bible isn't a story about our performance. In fact, instead of our performance, what we discover is that as terrible as those people in the Bible were, they needed forgiveness just like we needed forgiveness. And so when the psalmist says that there is a blessed man who doesn't walk in the counsel of the ungodly or stand in the way of sinners or sit in the seat of scoffers, but that his delight is in the law of the Lord and on his law he meditates day and night, we can be confident that it's not about us being the blessed man. That there is a blessed man who delighted in God's law, who always loved God's law, who perfectly obeys God's law. And because he was perfect in his obedience, he is the good shepherd who then leads us by streams of water, who brings us so that we might nourish our souls and be fed. And so suddenly the pressure is off. And I realize then that all of the things that I needed to accomplish, all of the troubles that I go through, I am far more loved than I ever dared realize, because I am far more problematic than I ever could have thought. And because of God's great love for me, it's not about my performance. It's about his performance. It's about what he has done for me so that I can know of his great saving love. So if the Bible is not about me and my performance, but it's about Jesus and his performance, is it about me being better as a person Or is it about living with a holy God? So when I started reading the Bible, I didn't understand the point of it. There's all sorts of rules, and there's all sorts of things that, well, how do I interpret them? Do I need to get rid of the leaven out of my house so that I'm somehow a faithful disciple of Jesus? If God cares about leaven, something as small as that, does he care about me? Is the point of David and Goliath that I need to chop off the head of some great beast with whom I'm struggling? Well, if the Bible was about me being a better person, I better figure out which rules I need to keep. And there's a lot of rules. And sometimes the rules don't make a whole lot of sense. I don't know how they fit together. And if I can't figure out how to do all the rules and know which ones are to keep, be kept and not, I'm going to be in a lot of trouble. But then something happened in my life where I began reading the Psalms. And I noticed Psalms of longing. I noticed Psalms like Psalm 42, "As the deer pants for streams of living water, so my soul longs for you, O God, the living God." Or Psalm 63, which says, "O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh yearns for you." I'm longing for you like I need a drink, like land that's parched, where there's no water. I've seen you in the sanctuary, and I beheld your power and glory, because your steadfast love is better than life. Or Psalm 84, which says, "How lovely is your dwelling place, O Lord God Almighty. My soul longs, yes, it even thirsts for the courts of the Lord." Or, I know Will's favorite verse, Psalm 27, verse 4. "One thing I ask, one thing that I seek, that I might dwell in your house, the house of the Lord, all the days of my life, and that I might gaze upon your beauty, and that I might inquire in your temple." Suddenly, the Bible was not about my performance, but rather, what I saw it was, there is a relationship that God longs for, that I would live with him and he with me. And here's what I began seeing, that my longings for rules is not going to make me a better person. The irony is that the more I know the rules, it's like the wet paint sign that says, don't touch. And I just want to go touch. I want to test and see if it's really wet. But I began seeing that the Bible is not a story that is intended to make me a better person by me trying harder and doing more, but rather it's about me living with God and gazing upon his beauty and being amazed by him. And when I see something so beautiful, when I see something so glorious, what do I want to do? Don't I want in my heart to suddenly move beyond this sense of trying harder, but rather being captivated by beauty? I'm going to press in to know this God, to love him, to live for him. And suddenly, as strange as this Bible is, I saw that God was making a way for me to live with him. I could read it fundamentally differently. The book of Leviticus is not about laws. It's about God dwelling near. It's about how does a holy, righteous, perfect God dwell with sinful humanity? And when I began to see that all of the accounts of Scripture, from Genesis to Revelation, are all about Jesus, it freed me. It freed me from the performance trap. It freed me from trying harder. It freed me from thinking that this is all about me, and rather that this is all about him. And that as I lose myself in the story of God, what I discover is that I glorify the main character by doing the best job that I can as a minor character. That it's not about me. And so by seeing that God wants to dwell with me, first in his tabernacle, then in his temple, then he comes in the person of Jesus, and then he dwells right within me by his Spirit, suddenly the Bible is a different story. It's a different account. It's all about Jesus. And so now, when I open those family albums, what I love seeing is not just me and the events of the story of my life, but suddenly I remember that I'm just one blip in the history of mankind. And one day I'll be forgotten. And this great story of my family, there are people who have come before me, and there are people who will come after me. And I will be just another picture on a page that will be turned one day and be forgotten. But if I live for the one who is the greatest and see that in that album the story includes me, where God has freed me, where he has loved me, I'm freed from performance, then I can see that God truly loves me, not by asking more of me, but by giving to me what I cannot receive, by giving what I desperately need. And so I'm freed from the performance trap, and I can see how God has shown his grace so that I might live and enjoy him forever. So, is the Bible all about you? Is it about your performance? Is it about you being better? Or is it about him, about knowing him, about living with him, about loving him? That changes everything. And then we are free to live for God.